This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back. This is the third hour of the program, and you are invited to participate by calling 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. A few things I want to get with you here. We got even got some audio first. Just to take a quick dip in the critical race theory pool, this is a teacher in Texas. You're going to hear two brief audio clips of her. She's sitting in her car, and she's talking to her phone. You know how people will record messages. And she's talking about critical race theory. Now, she's into it. She's all about it, but she's got a take on this that is a little bit different from what you've been hearing before. One thing I want to point out, though, is that I find it interesting. It's a cultural phenomenon, it seems. I see so many pictures, they're selfies of women sitting in their cars. And they take the picture. This is what they use for the avatar for, I guess, you know, Instagram or social media. A lot of women do these videos of themselves sitting in their car talking into the video. And I don't have anything against it. I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying it's a phenomenon that seems to be really widespread. And I just find it curious, you know, sitting in the car, talking to your phone, filming your video or taking your selfie picture seems to be all the rage right now. So anyway, here is this white Texas teacher who is favorable toward critical race theory. And she has two things to say in this video. We've broken it into two parts. Here's the first part.
Hey, great question. So first of all, like as a high school history teacher, critical race theory is not something that I explicitly teach. Like I don't teach that term. I don't ever use that phrase, but it's something that's basically woven throughout my entire US history class. It really is just the idea of a few things. One, that race is a social construct that still impacts our systems today. Two, that systemic racism is still around and is still a thing, and that there is still white privilege. There are obstacles that white people don't have to face that people who are not white still have to face. And it's the idea that like the way to solve racial disparities is not to like go tell people individually not to be racist. It's to look at the structures and the systems that are in place, especially the laws, and figure out how to make those more equitable and more fair to all people. And you really can't teach US history responsibly without including these elements. You can't talk about Bacon's Rebellion, Jim Crow. You can't talk about the war on drugs, none of that without including this type of thing.
All right. Okay. Whatever. And here's her second clip about the same length. And this is an add-on to what she was saying about critical race theory, which, as she says, is woven into her class.
White kids, you're all racist. There's literally nothing you can do about it. Just get really good at apologizing. You know what? As your teacher, I really know each and every one of you really well, and I know your hearts, but it's really important to understand that you can be like not racist as an individual, but still exist within a system that perpetuates racial disparities. And there's no need for any of us to feel bad about it, but we do need to accept that it exists and acknowledge it, and then try to challenge those disparities when we can. White kids, you're privileged. You've never had to work for anything in your life. Stop complaining. Privilege actually isn't like the existence of benefits. It's the lack of obstacles and barriers. So you've had to work really hard for a lot of things in your life, and you've had to overcome obstacles. It's just probably that the color of your skin wasn't one of them. The laws are racist, the Constitution is racist, America's racist. Thankfully, we eliminated most of like the explicitly racist legislation and institutions during the 60s and the Civil Rights Movement, but we're a democracy, right? And so our institutions are run by people, and people come to their life with experiences and biases, and so the institutions that they run probably carry those as well.
Play the beginning for me again, please, Jim. Just play the first 10 seconds of what she says, how she starts off.
White kids, you're all racist. There's literally nothing you can do about it. Just all right, get stop. Really good at apologizing.
Stop. Can you imagine having that dingbat teaching your fifth grade kids with that nonsense, as she says, woven into her U.S. history class? I feel so bad for you parents who have kids in public school that have to deal with this issue. So please, I encourage you, talk to your kids about this nonsense. White kids, you're all racist and there's nothing you can do about it. That is racism. That's racism. Grabbing a whole group of people Doesn't matter which one it is. Just happens to be white this time. But it's just as repugnant, it's just as reprehensible to be racist in that regard toward these white kids as it is if it were being done toward black kids or Mexican kids or any other group of people, just on the basis of their skin color. And so, as she said, this is woven into her history class. It's woven into biology. It's woven into any class you can think of that they're being taught in public school, all the way up to the institutions of higher learning. It is indeed woven into this, and you just got a little taste of what it's all about. Hey, everybody, if you're a certain skin color, you guys are racist, period. And there's nothing you can do about it. She says, just get really good at apologizing. That's all. I just wanted to share that with you, just for your, you know, your oddball freak moment of the week. There it is. Now, another thing, and this kind of tags on to this, the COVID has changed the landscape in many ways, as you know. One way is the New York Post has got an interesting article on this, and they're quoting the Associated Press. It has to do with the rise of homeschooling. I think many parents are fleeing the insanity of their public schools, like the lady you just heard from. And for many of them, they just want their kids to be out of reach of these whack job teachers who are spouting racism and teaching the kids how to be racist, all in the name of trying to be anti-racist. You notice that we're such a systemically racist country that we've elected a black president twice, and we have a black, I mean, I'll put the word in quotation marks only because Kamala Harris is Indian on her, I believe it's her mother's side, and her father was, I think, half Jamaican, half white, or half black Jamaican and then half white American. I don't know the exact ratios, but I think she's regarded, generally speaking, as a black vice president. Okay, fair enough. I have no argument with that. We're such a systemically racist country that the majority of people in this country voted for a black man to be president twice. And now our vice president. And not to mention all the other many high-level positions throughout government, not to mention, you know, the Congress and all of the other aspects of this country. This constant mantra of systemic racism, I think, is flatly refuted on the basis of facts like that. But in any case, back to homeschooling. The AP points out that although the pandemic disrupted family life across the U.S. since taking hold in the spring of 2020, some parents are grateful for one consequence. They're now opting to homeschool their children, even as schools plan to resume in-person classes. The specific reasons vary. Some families who spoke with the Associated Press have children with special educational needs. Others seek a faith-based curriculum, or they say their local schools are flawed. That would certainly get into the critical race theory nonsense, among other issues that are being foisted on the kids. The common denominator, they tried homeschooling on what they thought was a temporary basis, and they found it beneficial to their children. Danielle King of Randolph, Vermont, whose seven-year-old daughter Zoe thrived with the flexible one-on-one instruction, says, "That's one of the silver linings of the pandemic. I don't think we would have chosen to homeschool otherwise." Her curriculum includes literature, anatomy, even archaeology, enlivened by outdoor excursions to search for fossils. Black households, the AP says, saw the largest jump in their homeschooling rate. It rose from 3.3% in the spring of last year to 16.1% in the fall. The parents in one of those households are Lena and Robert Brown of Austin, Texas, have three elementary school age children, and when the pandemic took effect, they decided to experiment with virtual learning. They opted to try homeschooling with a Catholic-oriented curriculum provided by Seton Home Study School. Friends of Relevant Radio, we're very happy to see them in the Associated Press article. Way to go, Seton Home Study School! They serve about 16,000 students nationwide. The Browns plan to continue homeschooling for the coming year, grateful that they can tailor the curriculum to fit their children's distinctive needs. Jacoby, 11, has been diagnosed with narcolepsy and sometimes needs naps during the day. Riley, 10, has tested as academically gifted. And Felicity, 9, has a learning disability. Robert Brown, who himself is a former teacher, he says, "I didn't want my kids to become a statistic and not meet their full potential, and we wanted them to have a very solid understanding of their faith." And what's neat is that throughout the article, they give a lot of examples of people from various backgrounds, different races, different parts of the country, and they're all talking about why they decided to homeschool. You may remember It was this time last year when overnight it seemed that countless families found out, hey, we're going to be homeschooling the kids because they can't go to school during the height of the pandemic last year. And so the upshot of the article is that homeschooling is really coming into its own now. And the numbers of families that are homeschooling their kids is really rising. Back in the olden days, when Nancy and I decided to do homeschooling, it was not really a thing at that point. So we're talking about maybe, say, the late 1980s, I guess. And as I recall, it seems like even then it was almost a little bit risky. Like, what if the truant officer showed up and found your kids playing in the front yard during the day when the kids are supposed to be in school? Could you get in trouble? Was it legal to homeschool? And we did some due diligence. We found that technically it was legal. But they would prefer if your child was in school because of the federal monies and state monies that would come in to support the schools, all understandable. But back in those days, there was not much by way of infrastructure. And so homeschooling has grown a great deal since then. And if you're either homeschooling or you're thinking about homeschooling or you've heard about homeschooling, this would be a good article to take a look at from the Associated Press. And you'll find it on the show Twitter feed. Just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. You'll find it there. Let's go to Margaret now in St. Paul, Minnesota. Good morning, Margaret.
Oh, good morning, Patrick. So I have a question. I find coming up more and more that many people are putting a moral spin on those who are not getting the vaccination. Mm-hmm. And they will say things like, you know, it's immoral for them not to be thinking about health, the health and welfare of others. So selfish, you know, not loving towards your fellow man. But anyway, I know there's a comeback, and I'm wondering what you would say to that.
comeback be? Well, please keep in mind, I do not discourage people from getting vaccinations. I'm not anti-vax.
Right.
I don't discourage people. Yeah. So I'm not giving a comeback based upon my, you know, wanting to push back against that. But what I would say if I were in that situation, I would say, well, if you follow the science, you'll notice now that there's a huge increase in people who have been vaccinated, who are getting COVID, and they are contagious. Okay. So it's the irony of ironies. You know, if your desire to protect other people was the motivation for getting vaccinated, and it's a good motivation. I endorse it. If that was your motivation, that you're getting vaccinated so that you would protect other people, and now you find out that the preponderance of people who are carrying COVID, getting COVID, spreading COVID are themselves vaccinated, then maybe even though your desire is to protect other people, maybe is it possible that doing that has kind of backfired on you? And that you're now in a position where, because you're vaccinated, it seems maybe at a higher risk of giving the disease to somebody else, which is so weird, right?
Right, right, exactly. But yeah. And, you know, I mean, I'm vaccinated, but I know that I have friends that are not. And I feel like, you know, I understand too that there are good reasons not. I mean, there's so many questions surrounding it, and it's not FDA approved.
Another thing you could say, Margaret, is you could say, my body, my choice. And ask the person.
Thank you. That's great.
Ask the person. Try this on.
My
size,
body,
Margaret.
My choice, because they sure do shout that one for abortion.
There you go.
You know? Yeah.
There you go. So I ask them when, you know, if a woman says regarding abortion, my body, my choice, do you respect that or not? Do you agree with that or not? And if they say yes, then say, why do you agree with that? When another person's life is not only jeopardized, but the other person is dead at the end of the procedure, and she says, my body, my choice, and you recognize that somebody else's body gets destroyed in the process, and then let them fight their way out of that paper bag. Let them explain why they believe that it's okay for a woman to say, my body, my choice, with regard to abortion, but you as a woman can't say, my body, my choice, with regard to the issue of COVID and the vaccine. I realize you've been vaccinated. And then ask them to explain the difference. This is the key, because in both scenarios, somebody else's life is put in jeopardy. And in the case of abortion, the other person actually dies. So what's the substantive difference between a woman invoking my body, my choice with regard to a vaccine versus invoking my body, my choice with regard to an abortion? And then sit back and you know, have some popcorn while they try to figure that one out.
Right, exactly. Yes, thank you. That's very helpful. You know, I think it's very bothersome, the moral issue that they're bringing up with it. But that's a wonderful answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Margaret. Appreciate God bless you. Hang in there. Oh, let's see. Yeah, we have time to do some more phone calls. This is great. Let us go to Jordan in St. Paul, Minnesota. Good morning, Jordan.
Hi, Patrick. Happy belated Taco Tuesday.
Ah, thank you. I reciprocate.
Yeah. So my sister-in-law has 6 children. The oldest is 13. She's been using Seton Home Studies for homeschooling the entire way through with the children, not just now with COVID, and it's been absolutely fantastic for them.
That's good.
So I would like to definitely recommend it.
We love Seton Home Study School. We, you know, they're big friends of ours, and we do everything we can to let people know about them and what they do.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah. I'm recently married, and when my wife and I have children, God willing, we plan on using Seton Home Studies to homeschool them as well.
That's good. Well, I have a feeling that if Seton Home Study School is listening, they're smiling ear to ear right now, hearing you say that.
All thank
right,
you.
Jordan, thank you. I appreciate it very much. Yes, Nancy and I used, well, when I say Nancy and I, you know, the two shall be one, that's true, but Nancy did all the hard work. She's the one who actually did the homeschooling. I was out working to fund the operation, but Nancy's the one who did all the hard work when it comes to homeschooling. But I just wanted to mention in passing that we also made use of Seton homeschooling curricula when we were teaching our kids, or more like it, when Nancy was teaching our kids. And it is very good. So please check them out, Seton Home Study School. I will be right back with more, including I want to share with you an amazing and insightful look at the collapse of the Soviet Union and why this writer thinks it collapsed. The answer, I think, is going to surprise you. And he looks at what's going on in the United States right now. I'll be right back. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Real life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Do you remember when the Soviet Union collapsed? You know, it started collapsing in 1990 and it just went into free fall in 1991, and that was the end of it. And it was like after all those years, the Cold War, and the Soviet Union just seemed too big to fail, to coin a phrase here. Well, it was 30 years ago this month, as Ed West points out in his article called America Has Become Its Own Worst Enemy. 30 years ago this month, the Cold War ended with a failed coup in Moscow. It was remarked by many at the time that Marx's dictum that history repeats itself as farce proved true for the Soviet Union, the state that had defined itself by its ideology. Now, the point of this article is, look at what's going on in the United States today, and by way of looking at what happened to the Soviet Union. Now, if you weren't old enough, or maybe you weren't here on the planet when this all happened, this was a huge, unbelievable story. It's like, and it seemed to happen very quickly and almost out of nowhere. And next thing you know, the Soviet Union is gone. The evil empire, as it was called by President Ronald Reagan, El Presidente Ronald Reagan. And no, there's nothing disrespectful about saying El Presidente. For those who are bothered by that, please lighten up. El Presidente Ronald Reagan called it the evil empire, and so it was, because it was based upon godless communism. And it was ruthless and implacable and totalitarian, and it crushed everything and everyone in its path, and it wanted to do so to the United States. And you get to 1991, and suddenly it just collapses. So here's what Ed West says in his article. In August 1991, when the USSR's reforming General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev holidayed in his Ukrainian dacha, a group of hardliners seized power. Gorbachev, under house arrest, turned to the BBC radio to find out what was going on, since in the Soviet Union, nothing the media said was true unless the party said so. He learned that in the center of Moscow, Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin courageously stood in front of the city's White House in defiance of the plotters, surrounded by supporters brandishing the old Russian flag. Perhaps that wasn't clear to everyone. Perhaps what wasn't clear to everyone was that Yeltsin was drunk for much of it. The true extent of his alcoholism became more apparent in the years after he dissolved the communist state a few months later and became president of an independent Russia, although he already had a colorful reputation for drink-related antics. The plotters, it turns out, were also mostly legless. Having began a cack-handed group they weren't prepared to kill for, the ringleaders appeared on television looking ashen-faced, some shaking nervously, their insides rotting from vodka. Most of all, though, they just appeared old. Old and old beyond their years, the face of a fading empire based on a faith no one really believed in anymore. By this stage, and this is what I find fascinating about his perception of what's going on here, and you'll see how it ties into the United States in a minute. He says, by this stage, the Soviet Union was itself dying of alcohol, and attempts to treat it proved fruitless. One of the biggest mistakes made by Gorbachev, a very moderate drinker, which is why he's alive and his rival Yeltsin is long dead, one of the biggest mistakes made by Gorbachev was to raise the tax on vodka as part of a drive to tackle the country's catastrophic problem with drink. Russian humor is famously bleak and sharp and led to a joke in which a boy asks, Papa, and this means you shall drink less? No, son, this means you shall eat less. Alcohol played a central part in the demographic collapse that preempted the political fall of the USSR. It was back in the 70s that people first noticed that in the Soviet Union, people were starting to die younger. The decline in life expectancy affected not only the old, but the middle-aged. There was no famine, no foreign invasion, no natural disaster. Instead, people were drinking themselves to death out of despair. A country in which life is getting shorter and worse for its citizens has no future. Russia's birth rate had long ago collapsed, too. Two things drive higher fertility in wealthy countries, religion and affordability. All the major religions promoting childbearing give prestige and status to women who have children and to men who stick around. On top of that, attending a church, mosque, or synagogue is associated with a number of measures of well-being that breed optimism. The second factor is money. If both partners in a couple must work in order to survive, fertility is going to be severely depressed. The Soviet Union had extensive daycare provisions for mothers, but it was nowhere near enough to make up for the shortfall caused by mediocre wages. Back in the 1970s, Russian women marveled at how their American equivalents could afford to leave work while they had children. As the New York Times reported, they expressed astonishment when they learned that an American father can support a family of two or three or four children without his wife's working. Many are also surprised that American women could or would willingly have more than one child. For them, it was a struggle, a huge struggle, just to raise one child. The Soviet Union's main adversary in the Cold War was also defined by ideology to some extent. Many Western nations had embraced liberalism, but no other was created with the words of John Locke enshrined in its foundation. Yet liberalism, too, faced its challenges in the late 20th century, not from the obviously failing Soviet communism, but from rival ideas within the democratic tradition. Starting in the 1960s, a new way of thinking began to predominate in the U.S. that was not really liberal, although its opponents confusingly still referred to it as such. This new way of thinking was more hostile to freedom of speech, and its adherents began the process of chasing deviant thinkers out of academia. That began in the late 1960s and would massively reduce political diversity by the 21st century. It supported not just personal sexual freedom, as did liberalism, but radical ideas about sex, including hostility to the family. It was anti-religion and would become more so when religion clashed with sexual rights. As for freedom of association, the master freedom, in Christopher Caldwell's words, this was also incompatible with a worldview that prioritized equality over liberty. This new way of thinking, and he's talking about most of the West, but in particular he's talking here about the United States, this new way of thinking, progressivism, is probably the fairest term, is far less tolerant than liberalism. Indeed, in its hostility to freedom of speech, its Manichaean worldview, and that is referring to the Manichaean heresy that saw a duality in reality, that certain things were evil and certain things were good. So matter, the Manichaeans held, was evil and spirit was good. So this Manichaean worldview, its hostility to the freedom of speech, its suspicion that its opponents are fascists, and the belief that politics should be inserted into everything from science to children's books, it is closer to the totalitarian tradition. American progressivism is not communism, obviously, any more than its opponents are Nazis. The market is perfectly capable of achieving most progressive goals, and America has become more culturally left-wing as right-wing economic policies have dominated, globalization being the common theme that links the two. But globalism came with a price. With millions of jobs lost after the 2001 trade deal with China, made 2 months after George W. Bush had followed the Soviet example by invading Afghanistan, it was in those former industrial heartlands where people first began to notice an epidemic of drug-related deaths that now constitutes one of the highest, greatest social disasters in history. Four decades on, from its rival superpower, the United States had now become a country in which people were dying younger, driven by overdoses and suicides. That this epidemic took so long to register may have been the solitary and often legal nature of the drug problem. Unlike AIDS, it did not affect too many celebrities, Prince being the exception, and we can add a few others to that list. But it could also be who the victims were. Predominantly rural white Americans, neither powerful themselves nor championed by powerful supporters. Like the Soviet Union, the United States has developed a system in which some social classes and races are officially favored and some are disfavored, reflected in post-war legal innovations like affirmative action. Affirmative action was originally introduced as a countermeasure to segregation, either of the official or unofficial variety. But as with many things, its purpose evolved as bureaucracies grew. Today, government interference in private institutions is aimed at the goal of equality, not the liberal concept of equality of opportunity, but the more ambitious equality of outcomes, or equity. Under this theory, each racial group should have equal representation in elite institutions, which means that, depending on the race, Americans must achieve different scores to attend the same colleges. Equality is achieved through inequality. If this sounds illiberal, indeed un-American, that is because it is not unlike the nationalist policies created by communist revolutionaries and under which the Russian majority were officially discriminated against in certain positions. The Soviet nationality's policies allowed minority groups a certain degree of self-rule and recognition while also ensuring that their elites remained utterly under the control of the party. Sometimes other nationalities would be disfavored because they were seen as too anti-communist or otherwise disloyal, as happened to the Ukrainians, to the Tartars, and Jews at different times, but only Russian identity was actively discouraged. Stalin condemned the great Russian chauvinist spirit, and the Soviet Union saw majority nationalism as by far the greater evil. This did not lead to a brotherhood of man, amazingly. The ethnic spoils system benefited the party and minority members within it especially. But it is also a zero-sum game. The benefits of diversity, like the benefits of liberalism and capitalism, are supposed to be non-zero-sum and often are. Migrants benefit from moving to a richer and safer country. But the host population gains from their skills or cultural niches. When your immigrant neighbor gets rich, and even richer than you, not only will it not harm you, but you may well benefit. Equity, on the other hand, is similarly a zero-sum game. Someone has to lose. And if one group is fated or celebrated, in some cases even sacralized, then others have to suffer, whether the tangible matters like college places or simply status and prestige. And this is the conclusion. He says, today, America's thought leaders are obsessed with white nationalism and regularly denounced white supremacy as a lethal danger to the nation in what is probably history's least ever white supremacist country. a country in which the majority is officially discriminated against by certain institutions and where membership of the group is considered so tainted. This is referring here to white people. Membership in that group is considered so tainted and wicked that the media has regular denunciations of whiteness, and where numerous people avoid this taint by faking their ethnic origins. There are other resemblances to the older empire, referring here to the Soviet Union. At the heart of the Soviet thinking was the blank slate, the idea that life outcomes are determined entirely or almost entirely by social forces other than genes. As Mao said of the peasantry, a clean sheet of paper has no blotches, and so the newest and most beautiful words can be written on it. Likewise, American progressivism today is entirely built on the blank slate, and as in the USSR, where belief in Mendelian genetics led to internal exile, American social scientists offering any sort of genetic explanation face outcomes of ostracism. Privately, lots of people will agree, but they'll lose their job if they speak out, or their publisher will drop them, or it will only embolden the party's enemies and harm the noble goals of progressivism. Communists saw their political beliefs as so all-encompassing that even science was political. If science contradicted the goals of communism, it wasn't science. In today's United States, the slow death of liberalism has resulted in the blatant politicization of science, to the extent that, as in Russia, scientists teach things which are obviously untrue because it supports the prevailing ideology. Then there is the media, much of which parrots the party line with the almost embarrassing, "Comrade Stalin has driven pig iron to record production levels of conformity." Once again, if you want to hear the truth, go to the BBC until the young people who run that website take over. America, once the most trusting of societies, is heading in the direction of Russia, one of the least trusting. Most disturbing of all is that formerly the most demographically vibrant of the Western countries, today the United States has suffered a spectacular collapse in fertility. This is mostly down to stagnant wages among the middle class, who can no longer afford a family with one breadwinner, and a rapid decline of religious faith. But maybe people have also lost belief in themselves and the ideals of their country. The Soviet Union broke into 15 different pieces, and the transition was, as CNN might put it, mostly peaceful. That's a joke in there. Although Gorbachev's old dacha is now in Russia once again after some local unpleasantness, is referring to the Ukraine. Today, as it is the United States, where people talk of secession, escaping a crumbling superpower ruled by geriatrics. This seems very unlikely to happen, more clickbait than reality, because why would you leave what has been for more than two centuries the richest, most impressive state on earth? But then, a generation ago, few would have foreseen the Soviet Union crumbling in a haze of alcoholic despair. And I don't share that with you to cause despair, but maybe to say this guy's onto a few things. And some of his insights, including the connection between the scourge of alcoholism in Russia, I mean, it's still there. I don't know that it's gotten any better, but the contributing role that that had in the demise of the Soviet Union, and juxtaposing that with the spike in the drug deaths around the country, as he pointed out, largely in middle-class white America, that's just one of the comparisons that I think are well worth our time to consider. And that's why I wanted to share that with you. You'll find that article as well by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick and just look in the box for our Twitter feed. I'm going to take a break and we'll come back to your phone calls. The number to dial is 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Going one more time with that phone number, 888-914-9149. 9149. We'll go to Christina now in Las Vegas. Good morning, Christina. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning, Patrick. I have a question regarding my daughter who mentioned to me that she was planning to get married. Mm-hmm. And as Catholic, are we allowed to attend a wedding that is not Catholic because the boyfriend is non-Catholic? He's a Christian, supposedly, but then I don't think he goes to church on Sundays as well.
All right. So your daughter is the one getting married to him. She's Catholic. Yes. He's something, Protestant of some sort, right?
Christian, supposedly. I think an Orthodox.
Okay. That's an important difference then. Is he Eastern Orthodox or is he like an evangelical Protestant? Do you have an idea?
I have no idea at all. He doesn't even talk about it.
Well, I would, well, I mean, if your daughter is thinking of getting married to him, hopefully she's talked about it with him. Do you know offhand if they've discussed that?
Well, you know, my daughter right now is on the stage of sometimes she once asked me that, where's the proof that God exists? What is the proof that God exists? But you know, we raised my daughter and my son as Catholics. We were active in church and always attending Mass every Sunday.
That's good.
Used to, but now that they're grown ups, you know, my husband said it's up to them whether they want to attend or not.
Okay, I see the point you're making. So looking specifically at this wedding, because that was your question, your daughter is Catholic, even though she sounds like she's drifting away from her faith.
Yes.
The man that she's getting married to, if he is a, let's say, Greek Orthodox, for example, then
yes.
It would just simply require that that she have permission if they're going to get married at his church. I mean, if that's the question you're asking me, if they're going to get married at his church, because the Eastern Orthodox churches are, in fact, actual churches, they're separated from the Catholic Church, but we still recognize them and the validity of their sacraments. That can be done, and it wouldn't be a problem because he presumably is baptized and has received his sacraments if he is Orthodox. If he's Protestant, that is a different situation, and there could be a dispensation granted by your bishop to permit her to get married in that church, although, you know, what a shame that she's not getting married in the Catholic Church. But if she were to seek out permission, she could probably get that from the bishop in the form of a dispensation. But if she doesn't do that and she gets married in a way that's not the canonical form that the church requires, meaning that it's not witnessed officially by a Catholic priest or a deacon or a bishop for that matter, and it is celebrated, you know, maybe out in the woods or at the beach or something like that, then it would be an invalid marriage for her because in order to be valid, it has to have the canonical form. So these are all questions that will hinge upon what is the background of this young man and where do they plan to get married?
If it happens in a beach or somewhere else, that is something that's not valid, and we're not supposed to attend as well. Because I told her if it's not going to happen in Catholic Church, we can't attend her wedding.
Right. That's right. As painful as that is.
Is that correct? Am I?
Yeah, it is correct.
Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, I know that there are people who would disagree with me. Let me give you an example. I know that there are people who would say, well, they're your kids and you have to do everything possible to keep the line of communication open. And I agree with that up to a point. But I mean, if you know that this is going to be an invalid wedding and she's doing something that would be seriously sinful for her in this case, I don't see how you can go and pretend that everything is great and smile and celebrate and drink champagne when you know that this is an invalid marriage. That's the painful aspect of all this, is that it puts you as the parents in a very difficult situation where with every ounce of your being, you want to support your daughter and be there for her because you love her. And yet she's doing something that makes it almost impossible for you to do that because of the things that we just discussed. So my hope is maybe you can just reason with her. Are you going to be paying for any portion of the wedding reception? Yeah, anything like that?
That's what I told her also. We cannot pay for anything that is non-Catholic wedding.
Yeah, just tell her, hey, listen, we'll be, to whatever extent you and your husband are planning to or willing to pay for this, just say we're happy to do it. We'll write the checks. But one condition is you have to get married in the Catholic Church, as the church requires. If you will do that, then not only will we be there and we can celebrate, but we can also help you underwrite this. But if you're not going to do this the right way, then we can't write a check for that because you're doing something that's objectively wrong for you. That's what I would tell her, Christina. And I know this is painful for you. I can only imagine. I would get her a copy of Steve Wood's book, The ABCs of Finding a Good Husband. Now, who knows? This guy may be the greatest thing since sliced bread. He might be an awesome boyfriend, and he might make a great husband. Although, if he's not Catholic, that's a strike right there, because it will make the marriage that much more difficult, assuming that she at some point wants to practice her faith in a serious way. But I would give her that book, The ABCs of Finding a Good Husband by Steve Wood. And maybe as things are developing, she'll read that and perhaps even come to her senses about doing the right thing. I hope that's helpful. Thanks for the call, Christina. Let's go to Tim now in Marion, Iowa. Hi, Tim.
Hi, good morning, Patrick. Thank you for having me on your show.
Sure.
And thank you for all that you and your staff are doing for Catholicism. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
My call is related to the vaccines. I was wondering if you were aware of the National Vaccine Act of 1986. It was passed by Congress, signed by the president.
No, I'm not. So that would be okay. President Reagan. Can you give me the essence of that?
Yes, it's to establish a program to monitor, to manage, to encourage pharmaceutical industry in terms of vaccine development.
Is this the one? Can I guess? I need to guess here. Is this the one where it held harmless? It indemnified essentially against lawsuits the pharmaceutical companies, so that they could not
exactly
be...
right.
Okay. I do remember.
Exactly
yes.
right.
Okay.
Yep. It basically, they call it the vaccine court. So as a part of that, they established a reporting system. It's called VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Effects Reporting System.
Okay.
Which is a huge database, which is being administered by HHS. And that's where people can go and report if they've had any adverse effects. They're a very large tracking database. What's not being talked about with the COVID vaccines is the fact that there is a very large number of adverse effects being reported. I did a search on the database this morning. It came back with over 430,000 reports. The system timed out on me and only reports 10,000 lines.
Wow.
So the people that we talk to, the websites and so forth I just think it's a tragedy that the mainstream media is not talking about this. I'm not saying people shouldn't take the vaccine. I understand that they have valid reasons for doing that, but I think they also have to talk about the other side of the story. And again, there is a very large number of adverse effects being reported, including deaths. I talked to my wife this morning. Over 11,000. So usually what happens is when a vaccine is developed, if there are a few deaths, they basically put it on a watch list. Like, we're talking 5 or 10. I mean, any life lost is a tragedy.
Sure.
So we need to understand what the risks are, and we need to monitor that. But the fact of the matter is, I see no one talking about the adverse effects and the deaths because of these vaccines.
Well, we do
which,
here.
By the way, aren't really vaccines. They're what? I'm sorry, say that again?
No, I was just going to say, we do touch upon that topic from time to time, even
you do,
maybe
yes.
frequently. Yeah. But,
yes, but
you're not going to hear that on CNN. That's for sure.
Exactly. And that's why I wanted to bring it up. I think if you wanted to do a short segment at some point on the actual statistics that are being reported, and just make sure that people understand that the system is out there. So again, our understanding is only 10% of the public is even aware of this reporting system, which is another national tragedy.
Yeah.
That people aren't aware that the data is out there so that they can look at it and make informed, educated decisions for themselves.
That's a good point.
That's my first point. And again, I mean, the numbers that we're talking about on the...
Well, Tim, I don't have time to get too deep into that because we're getting close to the end of the hour and I got a bunch of people
Understood.
Holding. But that's mm-hmm. good what you brought up, though. I'm glad you did that. And just say it again no for problem. People who want to jot it down and go look for it.
It's called the Vaccine Adverse Effects Reporting System. It's V-A-E-R-S. If you search on it, it's under HHS.
Got it. Thank you. And by the way, just as a little tidbit here, St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Marion, is that by chance a church near you?
It is near us, yes.
I spoke at that church about 30, it might have been close to 35 years ago.
Yeah. And you were, I believe you were actually in town last year. I wasn't able to attend, but I think you were in for the men's conference last year over at Xavier High School. Thank
I
you.
Was, exactly, yes. But I have memories of speaking at that church a long time ago. And I don't know why I remember that, but when I saw that you were in Marion, Iowa, I realized that I had been there. Thank you, Tim. Let's go to Dan now in Yorkville, Illinois. Good morning, Dan.
Hi.
Hi to I don't know what happened to our listener. If you're still there, just hang tight. Let's go to Jill now in Santan Valley, Arizona. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Jill. Hi.
So my call is about my husband and I are very active Catholics mm-hmm. and raised our four children to be Catholic. Our son, our oldest, has married into a Mormon family and has okay. decided to become Mormon. Okay. The problem that we're coming up with now is with the grandchildren. We have three grandsons, their celebrations in their church, blessings. I think our oldest grandson will be coming up to a baptism only because we have other friends of theirs mm-hmm. who have invited us to like baptisms and things. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know. It's hard being a grandparent not to be involved in their activities.
Right.
Especially something that seems so special in their life to not go to those things. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know what we should be doing.
Yeah, this is a tough one. And one reason that complicates this, Jill, is that the church, the Catholic Church, does not recognize Mormon baptisms as valid. And there's, right. there's, it has a lot to do with the way in which Mormons understand God. And I talked a little bit about that earlier on the program today. So I can right. understand the dilemma here. And as a grandfather myself, I could see myself going to one of these baptisms, not to endorse it or something, but to demonstrate that even though these beloved family members are Mormon and have a very different religion, that I still love them and I'm willing to be present at this. They're not doing something actively sinful, but they're just deeply mistaken in what they think is happening here. So unlike, say, going to a wedding where you know that this is going to be celebrated in a way contrary to the teaching of the church, these people are not even Catholic. Okay, so these children, sadly, are not even Catholic. So it puts this in a different category, in my view, that would make it permissible, I think, for you to go, where you could be there. And the long-term goal, I would think, Jill, is that the more these grandchildren know you and love you and see you and trust you, the more likely you're going to be able to evangelize them as they get older. Because you'll have greater standing and you will be a friendly figure to them. If, on the other hand, these little Mormon kids, they never saw their grandparents or they saw them only rarely or they never saw them at some of these events in their lives, I would think that the likelihood of them being willing to listen to you or turn to you down the road might be less. That's all. So this is a strategic Perfect. Move, I think, on your part, if you were to do this.
Great. Great. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jill. God bless you and these little children. You know, maybe you can convince their parents to allow you to give the children a crucifix or a miraculous medal. I'm guessing they would probably say no, but wouldn't hurt to try. You know, give them a rosary and say, this is a rosary. You can pray the prayers of Scripture with it. And, you know, couldn't hurt to give them a try. Anyway, Thank you for that. Oh, you know what? We have reached the end of the road as far as the phone calls go because we are now out of time. So my sincere apologies to those of you who are holding. Do call me tomorrow. We'll try to get you on the air. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. The number to dial if you want to be on the program tomorrow, dial this 21 hours from now, 888-914-9149. And in the meantime, if you want to send me a message, you're welcome to do so by going to the show page, which is relevantradio.com/Patrick. You can send me a message. It comes directly to me, and I read all of them that come through. You can also send me a message on Twitter, and my address there is @PatrickMadrid. I post all kinds of stuff on there. Some of it's humorous, some of it's serious, but if you want to follow me on Twitter, that would be great. I'd look forward to seeing you there. And then lastly, remember that all the articles that I talk about on the program every single day get posted on the show Twitter feed, which is @PMadridShow, but you can access it directly by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Everything is there. So the links and the videos and everything, it's all there waiting for you. So please take advantage of that. I'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Same Pat time, as I say. And between now and then, I'll pray for you as I always do. Please pray for me. God bless you. La 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 la.